COP23, the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany. This is Democracy Now!
We're here to tell the world that Donald Trump does not represent the majority view in our country, that overwhelmingly people do believe that the planet is dangerously warming and that human activity is causing it and that we have to do something about it.
That's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, one of many U.S. senators, mayors, and governors who are staging an anti-Trump revolt here at the U.N. Climate Summit, declaring, "We are still in." That's in the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Accord. But what exactly do they mean? We'll speak with Senator Markey and Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz. But first, President Trump meets with Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte in Manila.
We've had a great relationship. This has been very successful. We have many meetings today with many other leaders. The ASEAN conference has been handled beautifully by the president and the Philippines and your representatives. And I've really enjoyed being here.
We'll speak with Tetet Laurent, a former member of the Philippines climate delegation, about the significance of Trump's meeting with Duterte. And we'll talk about the threats climate change poses to island nations with the Philippines climate activists and with Pacific climate warrior George Nathawa of Fiji. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 330 people have died in Iran after a powerful magnitude 7.3 earthquake hit the western province of Kermanshah near the Iraqi border. More than 4,000 people were injured. The death toll is expected to rise as rescue workers reach remote regions. At least six people died in Iraq as well. During the last stop of his Asia trip, President Trump openly praised Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte, saying the two had a great relationship. Since Duterte was elected in 2016, more than 7,000 people have been extrajudicially killed by police or vigilantes. According to Duterte's spokesperson, Trump did not raise any concerns about Duterte's human rights record.
Well, there was no mention of human rights. There was no mention of extralegal killings. There was only a rather lengthy discussion about the Philippine war on drugs, with President Duterte doing most of the explaining.
Both Trump and Duterte also refused to take questions from the media. When reporters attempted to ask about human rights, Duterte told the reporters, quote, "You are the spies," unquote, which reportedly made Trump laugh. Prior to Trump's arrival in the Philippines, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the U.S. Embassy. Police fired water cannons to disperse the protesters. This is Renata Reyes, the head of the New Patriotic Alliance.
Trump is no friend of the Filipino people. He brings war. He brings economic impositions. He wants to bring the U.S. war on terror in the Philippines. He wants to drag us into conflict in North Korea. He wants to bring back U.S. bases in the Philippines. These are things that are not beneficial to the Filipino people.
President Trump was in Manila for the opening of a summit of ASEAN. That's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The regional body is facing criticism for failing to address the crisis in Burma, where the United Nations has accused the military of Burma of waging a campaign of ethnic cleansing against the Rohingya Muslims. Burmese leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi spoke in Manila but did not mention the crisis. Aung San Suu Kyi was once a critic of ASEAN's policy of non-interference. In 1999, when she was fighting for democracy in Burma, she wrote, quote, "This policy of non-interference is just an excuse for not helping. In this day and age, you cannot avoid interference in matters of other countries," she said at the time. In other news from Asia, the U.S. and North Korea openly traded insults over the weekend. North Korea described Trump as a warmonger and an old lunatic. Trump responded on Twitter by writing, quote, "Why would Kim Jong-un insult me by calling me old when I would never call him short and fat?" Former CIA Director John Brennan and James Clapper, the former Director of National Intelligence, have openly criticized President Trump after he cast doubts on the intelligence community's findings about Russian meddling in the 2016 election. During a conversation with reporters aboard Air Force One, Trump said he believes Russian President Vladimir Putin's denials and questioned the conclusions of the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies. Trump said about Putin, quote, "Every time he sees me, he says, I didn't do that. And I really believe that when he tells me that, he means it." Trump went on to describe Brennan and Clapper as political hacks. Trump later walked back his remarks, saying he accepts the opinion of the U.S. intelligence agencies. In news from Europe, over 750,000 supporters of Catalan independence marched in Barcelona Saturday, calling on Spain to release 8 members of the deposed Catalan government.
I'm here because there are political prisoners that should not be in jail. We are appalled, angry, and mad because of this situation, because people don't deserve it. We do things peacefully with the desire to build a country and without any desire to hurt anyone.
The Catalan leaders were jailed by Spain after the Catalan government declared independence on October 27th. The region's former president, Carles Puigdemont, who is now in Belgium, also faces charges. Meanwhile, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy traveled to Barcelona Sunday for the first time since imposing direct rule on Catalonia. He vowed to end what he described as, quote, separatist havoc. On Saturday, Poland witnessed one of the largest rallies by fascists in Europe in years. Some 60,000 people took part in a far-right march in Warsaw to mark Polish Independence Day. Demonstrators threw red smoke bombs and chanted, "Pure Poland, White Poland," and "Refugees, get out." One banner read, "Pray for Islamic Holocaust." The Polish Interior Ministry called the event a beautiful event. In other news from Europe, a German newspaper has published the names of over 33,000 migrants and refugees who've died attempting to reach Europe since 1993. The German newspaper Der Tagesspiegel published the list on November 9th, the anniversary of Kristallnacht, when German Nazis launched a wave of violent anti-Jewish pogroms. According to the UN International Organization for Migration, 2016 was the deadliest year to date for migrants attempting to reach Europe, with more than 5,000 deaths. Another 3,000 people have died so far this year. Lebanon remains in a state of crisis more than a week after its prime minister, Saad al-Hariri, unexpectedly resigned while on a trip to Saudi Arabia. Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, and others have accused Saudi Arabia of kidnapping Hariri and forcing him to resign against his will. On Sunday, Hariri gave his first televised interview since arriving in Saudi Arabia. On Friday, Hezbollah leader Syed Hassan Nasrallah condemned Saudi's interference in Lebanese politics. In news from Africa, the U.S. has carried out at least 3 drone strikes in Somalia since Saturday in an intensification of the U.S. campaign against the militant group al-Shabaab. Some 400 U.S. troops are also now operating in Somalia, quadruple the number from when Donald Trump took office. In Alabama, Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore is facing increasing calls to drop out of the closely watched race after at least 4 women accused him of making sexual advances on them while they were teenagers. On Saturday, Moore defended himself. But several of Roy Moore's former colleagues have publicly acknowledged it was common knowledge that when Moore was in his 30s, he would date teenagers. Meanwhile, Axios is reporting Steve Bannon has dispatched 2 Breitbart employees to go to Alabama to dig up dirt on the women who publicly spoke out against Moore. The entertainment, political, business, and athletic worlds continue to be rocked by new reports of sexual abuse and misconduct by prominent men. On Friday, the comedian Louis C.K. admitted reports were true that he mistreated women and masturbated in front of fellow female comics. Other men facing accusations of sexual misconduct include the actors Steven Seagal, Richard Dreyfuss, and George Takei. former FIFA president Sepp Blatter, Warner Brothers TV executive Andrew Kreisberg, film producer Gary Goddard, and Jesse Lacey of the band Brand New. Meanwhile, the three-time Olympic gold medal gymnast, Ali Raisman, has revealed she was sexually abused by Larry Nassar, the former doctor of the U.S. women's gymnastics team. She spoke on 60 Minutes to John LaPook. More than 130 women and girls have now accused Larry Nassar, the former doctor of the U.S. women's gymnastics team, of abuse. He's currently in jail awaiting sentencing on child pornography charges. Meanwhile, in Hollywood, California, hundreds took part in the Me Too Survivors March Sunday. Participants included 21-year-old Tara McNamara of Los Angeles.
Every woman in my life that I've ever known has been sexually assaulted or sexually harassed. I've been sexually assaulted. I've been raped. I've been sexually assaulted multiple times throughout my life. It's affected me in every, like, aspect of my life. It's given me major depression. I always have tried to speak out about these things, and there's always been kind of this awkwardness around it or hesitation with people to speak about it. This is really cleansing.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, we are broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany, where representatives from nearly 200 nations have gathered for negotiations aimed at bolstering the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Accord. This year, Fiji has made history by becoming the first small island nation to preside over the UN Climate Summit. The event itself is being held in Bonn because of the logistical challenges of hosting 25,000 people in Fiji at the start of the South Pacific cyclone season. But it's still being called the Island COP. Climate change poses a particularly devastating threat to low-lying island nations like Fiji. A new report says Fiji would have to spend $4.5 billion over the next decade to adapt to climate change, a sum equivalent to its entire annual gross domestic product. Meanwhile, a new report released today shows climate change threatens one in four natural world heritage sites, from the Florida Everglades to Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This year's climate change conference comes after President Trump has vowed to pull the United States out of the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Last week in Bonn, Syria signed on to the Paris deal, meaning that if President Trump fulfills his vow to pull the U.S. out of the deal, the United States would become the only nation on Earth that is not a party to the agreement. There are, in fact, a number of U.S. delegations here in Bonn, though. One is a coalition of U.S. lawmakers, universities, companies, and faith groups that are staging an anti-Trump revolt by rejecting Trump's action and declaring, "We are still in." Well, on Saturday, a group of protesters, many of whom were Native American, disrupted California Governor Jerry Brown's speech here in Bonn, calling on California to ban fracking. The protesters yelled, "Keep it in the ground."
Yeah, I wish we could have no pollution, but we have to have our automobiles.
In the ground.
I agree with you. In the ground. Let's put you in the ground so we can get on with the show here. Anyway.
That's California Governor Jerry Brown Saturday saying, "Let's put you in the ground." Well, I questioned Governor Brown about his comments just before we went to broadcast today. On Saturday, a group of protesters, mainly Native American, disrupted your event and called for a ban on fracking.
No, they were calling for a ban on all oil production.
So they said
keep
it in the ground, and you responded by saying, "Let's put you in the ground." Can you explain what you meant?
That was a joke. Now, I mean, don't use your media outlet for this kind of silliness. Now, that was a ironic remark in the face of a noisy demonstration when it's very hard to even hear, much less keep your thought there.
And, but it was Native Americans, and they took it very seriously.
Do you apologize for
that comment?
No, come on. You know that in California, we have the strongest Native American policy of any state in the country. And we have the most environmental, and we have the toughest rules on oil. I don't think we should shut down oil in California and then take it from Venezuela or take it from places where the rules are even worse. we have to stop the cars. We have to get electric. We have to get public transportation. We need better land use. We've got to solve the problem. And I understand because we deal with protests all the time. But California, we are cutting our oil consumption. We're cutting our greenhouse gases. That's what we have to do, not just a slogan or a march around or talk. I'm talking about reality. And California has the strongest oil reduction rules in America. We're the leader. If someone wants to say, oh, get rid of oil, you mean get rid of our cars. If you got rid of cars, you'd have a revolution and there'd be shooting in the streets.
They were calling on a ban on fracking, like New York and Maryland.
Of oil production.
But also fracking. What is your approach to that?
Is, I don't think it makes sense to import oil by train. It's very dangerous. And people who say, hey, don't take oil out of your ground, bring it by train or by boat, that's far more dangerous. The answer is stop using oil in cars, in trucks. You need a renewable vehicle grid. That's the answer. And I think to say anything else is not intellectually honest and is not helpful.
Are you considering
we're
a ban
actually
on
moving.
Fracking?
Thank you. Let's go.
We're considering a ban on oil over the next 25 years. We're reducing it. That's pure rhetoric. Pure rhetoric. What are you going to do
if New York and Maryland did it?
We've got to go. We've got to go.
Because they don't have the same situation. Pennsylvania didn't do it. Okay. This is just kind of a little left-wing routine here.
I don't think fracking
is.
Fracking is a very serious issue.
Fracking is very serious, and horizontal fracking is very dangerous and uses 10 times the water. And in California, it's a very small part. What I'm talking about, we'd like to get rid of all oil drilling. But we have to do it in a systematic way, reducing the demand and not just the supply. Because if we don't reduce the demand, we'll get the supply by boat and by train, and that is really dangerous to human beings. People die from the training of bringing in of oil. So that's the honest truth. I don't know whether that is something you're going to want to deal with, but I'm telling you the way it is.
So that was California Governor Jerry Brown. Meanwhile, on Saturday afternoon here in Bonn, thousands of people took to the streets for a rally and march to demand an end to fossil fuel extraction. These are some of their voices.
Hi, my name is Kalasa Groman. I'm from the Bonn Youth Movement, and we are here today because we think that that climate change, that environmental pollution is not just one cause, it's not just the carbon emissions, it's not just coal, it's everything. It's nuclear power. It's the way that we are putting war all over the planet and destroying it. It's the way that our economic system is working for the profit of few.
My name is Katia Aviles Vasquez. I came from Puerto Rico to be here in Bonn. Part of the reason I'm here is the Caribbean just got hit with two major force hurricanes, and we had unusually high activity of hurricanes, particularly part of the effects of increased temperature due to climate change. And while we're living and struggling through the effects of climate change, the decisions that are causing it are being made here. And I'm hoping by being here, we can kind of highlight the struggles that we're going through, what climate change is doing in the now. This is not something to prepare for in the future. We're living it, we're suffering, we're dying at this moment. We have lost power, we lost communications, we lost potable drinking water, and our economy is collapsing due to that. So we need climate reparations. One of the things that we're demanding, ending the Jones Act, ending the colonial rule and PROMESA. We want to be able to work, trade, and heal with our Caribbean sister islands like they have offered to help, but the U.S. has told them no. And we want to make sure that we transition into renewables, not just rebuilding the Puerto Rico of old that replicates the oppression that led us to being in such vulnerable positions.
Just as we flew here from the United States, we saw whatever power was restored to San Juan. When we were in San Juan, there was some pockets of electricity. That once again, San Juan has been plunged into darkness. That's just San Juan, which is the most successful in returning electricity.
Correct. That's actually been one of the most painful things about being here, is seeing that whatever little progress was made, we set up a couple of steps back. And it's important to highlight that was the one line that Whitefish fixed. and not only that Whitefish got that contract because their owner or someone has stocks that's a Trump donor. So again, it highlights the need to for whatever transition we demand needs to be just, it needs to correct past depressions, and it needs to be towards renewable, not just fixing an old and decaying infrastructure. The other thing that happened while we were here, just today it came out that FEMA is going to relocate at least 3,000 Puerto Ricans out of Puerto Rico when we have so much housing that's available and that's apt to have humans. They're moving our people out systematically. Now it's the gentrification that was already happening due to Law 2022 is now being officialized by the U.S. government, and that's just completely unacceptable.
My name is Monica Atkins, and I am here representing Corporation Jackson in Mississippi, as well as the Climate Justice Alliance. And I'm here to stand in solidarity with the communities of color, indigenous people whose land are being polluted, whose waters are being polluted, and whose land is being taken over. So we're just here standing in solidarity and showing support.
My name is Chief Ninua. I am from Acre, Brazil, with the Hunikui people. I came to bring a message from the forest to this climate conference. This message is of life, love, peace, and hope.
Não aceitamos que a natureza ela vire
We believe that nature should not be commercialized for big capital. We came here to demand respect for human beings, for the water, for the forest, and everything that depends on the forest.
Depende da floresta para sobreviver.
My name is Miriam Cisneros. I'm the president of Sarayaku and Quechua people in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I'm here because the indigenous people around the world are affected by climate change. And we came with a proposal, the Living Forest proposal, to advance this call for the Living Forest, but also to join forces and gain solidarity from other people, other movements, and so that we can unite and be in this fight together.
I'm Dario Krockenberger and I'm from Wiesbaden in Germany. Ich denke, dass das wird an der Weltklimakonferenz.
It's become evident from what we've seen at the World Climate Conference that is in progress here that the climate targets that they had established are not sufficient. At the same time, it is clear that they are not truly willing to carry them out anyway. I believe that there is enough wealth in the world to be able to accommodate both our concerns for the environment as well as job security for workers. In other words, there need not be starvation or unemployment, because there is enough work in the world, and it is more a question of how to spread it around among all. We need the environment. We cannot exist without it. Therefore, the question is simple for me. It is that capitalism lies at the basis of our problems, and that we critically need groundbreaking alternatives to it.
Grundsätzliche Alternativen brauchen.
Voices from the streets of Bonn, Germany, here on Saturday. When we come back, we'll look at President Trump's meeting with Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte in Manila and the threats climate change poses to the Philippines and other island nations, like the host of the Bonn summit. It's called the Island COP. We'll talk with a climate warrior from Fiji. Stay with us.
Una sa lahat para sa bagong pangulo na ang dapat niya talaga naggawin ay ang mamuno sa ating bansa, baguhin ang lahat ng nakasanayan. Ang sabi mo sa amin lahat yung patutunayan. Sa anim na buwan muna pagkakaupo sa pwesto, sa anim na buwan ay meron na nga bang magbabago na pamamalakad sa bansa naming sinilangan. Tama pa ang desisyon pagkatapos ng halalan. May ilang bumoto na nailibing na sa huhay. May ilang tao pa ba ang mawawalan ng buhay? Pagkatitiyak kung kailan pa nga ba matatapos ang patayan at barilan, eto ba ang bagong datos? Ang buhay ng Pilipino kahit na isang tukha, isa ako sa nawalan, may mahabang pagluluksa. At hanggang ngayon, tago sa puso ang mga pangyayari. Meron nga bang katarungan, parang walang makapagsabi. Kailangan bang gamitan ng dahas? Kamay na bakal ang umiral na batas. Solusyon ba sa pagbabago? Magbawas ng tao na maaari pang magbago kaso nagwakas ang buhay dahil napasama lang sa kota. Itong babasta na impluensyahan ng droga. Babalahan, paplakahan, pusher at huwag tutularan. Sasabihin ng laban kahit walang kalaban-laban. Nasaan na nga ba ang ating karapatang pangtao? Bakit mga
mga biktima ay initil na parang aso. Di man lang binigyan pagkakataong magbago, pinis lang ganoon na lang animalang pagkatrato.
Vestisia, Justice by Jay. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany, that's actually hosted by Fiji. Well, the UN Climate Summit comes as President Trump is in the Philippines as part of his 13-day trip across Asia. Hours ago, Trump met with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte on the sidelines of the ASEAN Summit. That's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Manila. Trump said he has a great relationship with Duterte, who's presided over a so-called war on drugs that's seen thousands of people killed by police or vigilantes since Duterte took office. The meeting came after Duterte sang a Filipino love song during a gala dinner Sunday night with other world leaders, saying later he sang it on the orders of President Trump. This all comes just a few days after Duterte bragged about having stabbed someone to death when he was 16 years old. During Duterte's campaign, he also joked about wanting to have been first in line for the gang rape of an Australian missionary who was raped and murdered in 1989. Duterte said, quote, "She was so beautiful, the mayor should have been first. What a waste," unquote. Duterte himself was the mayor of Davao City. Well, for more on President Trump's trip to the Philippines and the threat that climate change poses to the Philippines and Southeast Asia, we're joined by Tetet Laurent, Program Manager for Climate Justice at EBON International. She was a member of the Philippines delegation to the UN Climate Summits from 2011 to 2013. Before we talk climate politics, let's talk the politics of your country and President Trump coming to the Philippines. You know, every UN Climate Summit, it seems, over the last years, we're dealing with a typhoon in the Philippines. What about this year?
Well, today we are facing an even more destructive and horrible cyclone, and that is President Donald Trump himself.
What do you mean by that? And talk about his trip and his so-called, as he described it, great relationship with Duterte, your president.
Yeah. As we speak, I'm very proud to say that a lot of thousands of activists, thousands of farmers, workers are trooping down the streets of Manila to disrupt this meeting of the ASEAN and also to say that Trump is not welcome in the Philippines. The Philippines and the United States have always had that special relationship in the sense that, you know, governments and presidents, even before Duterte, have welcomed U.S. policy with open arms and very welcoming of U.S. investments, U.S. corporations, taking away our resources, exploiting our people, and just getting away with virtually everything, even military exercises.
Can you give us a history? I did a little bit of his human rights record. I mean, he's only been president for a year now, just as President Trump has been. But, I mean, the story of 1989, him saying he wishes he was first in line to rape an Australian missionary who was raped and murdered. To talk about just the last few days, he says he murdered a person when he was 16 years old.
Yeah, you can really see the character, you know, that he's racist, he's sexist, he's misogynist, and he's militarist. In his reign as 20 years as mayor of Davao, everyone knows, but it's not really admitted officially that he was, you know, he has a Davao death squad behind him, keeping peace and order in Davao, and he's doing it right now. No, and he even brags that he could put the whole country, the entire country, under martial law anytime he wants to.
And the significance of Trump saying that he, in a sense, supports, he says he has a great relationship with Duterte. What does that mean for the Filipino people?
It only goes to show Duterte's true colors. Initially, he said that he was going to pursue an independent foreign policy. He was very critical of the United States. But what we're seeing now is that these two guys, these two macho bullies, have a very special relationship and that they like each other. So what does it say about the policies, no? Duterte is here to follow or to be obedient to whatever the U.S. says.
Hmm. What is the name that people have for Donald Trump and Rodrigo Duterte?
Oh, we call them Duterte Trump because they're basically of the same mold.
We are talking with Tete Laurent, who is with Ebon International, and we are now joined as well by George Nathawa, who is a Fiji Islander and a Pacific climate warrior. Let's now pivot into the issue of climate. We'll stay with you, Tete. How does climate affect the Philippines, and what are you calling for here at the UN Climate Summit?
Well, the Philippines has always been poster child of the climate change. And as you said, especially during COPs, you know, one big typhoon hits our country and earthquake strikes affecting millions. So at this COP, we're hoping and calling on governments to be accountable, number one, to make good on the promises that they made 2 years ago in Paris. And number two, because what they've put in as pledges in the Paris Agreement is not enough because it's still going to bring us anywhere between 3 to 7 degrees warming. We're calling on them, you know, to increase the level of ambition, note the urgency, and really just try to do and everything that they could to avoid runaway climate change.
We're also joined by George Nathawa, who is a Fiji Islander. So, George, your country is actually hosting the summit. It's called the Island COP, but it's being held in Bonn because Fiji couldn't deal with 25,000 people coming in all at once for the summit. But talk about how climate affects Fiji and place it for us geographically.
So Fiji, impacts of climate change in the islands is such that we have sea level rise, saltwater intrusion, harsh weather patterns, flooding. But just last year, we had the worst cyclone, the Category 5 cyclone, that hit Fiji. It was devastating to see thousands of homes damaged and about 40 people lost their lives. And this is something that we've never experienced before. And, yeah.
And the significance of this being an island COP, it's your island that's hosting this, yeah. Fiji?
I mean, this is to show the world what true leadership is all about, you know, and we have our leaders from the islands that are pushing that affirmative action is taken and that the Paris Agreement is put into play, you know, and that. Yeah.
What does it mean to be a Pacific climate warrior?
It means we bring our faith, our culture, our tradition into the mix of things, you know, and to show people who we are as human beings from the islands, and that we are connected to the land and to the ocean, and that this is important to us.
And the fact that President Trump is pulling the U.S. out of the UN Paris Climate Accord, what does it mean to you?
It's frustrating. I'm angry, but at the same time, I'm hopeful and to see that our island leaders are taking the true leadership role that is needed.
And Tete Laurent, the fact that Trump, yes, is in your country right now in the Philippines, you're here in Bonn for the island summit, this island COP. What does it mean to you that the U.S. now, what, following Syria and just before that Nicaragua signing on to the Paris Climate Accord, that means the U.S. is alone if it, in fact, is pulled out of the accord, even with Trump's efforts to pull it out. He actually can't pull it out till 2020. I think it's a day after the next election.
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. has never been a climate leader. So, you know, it doesn't really matter much if they stay in or they stay out of the agreement. It's because we haven't seen real climate leadership. There's still the role of the U.S. policy, and it's not just about the environmental policy. It's also about trade. It's about finance. It's about putting in place policies that extract more resources from countries like the Philippines and Fiji and bringing in their corporations with destructive mining activities, you know, opening up our country and our people to even more damages and vulnerability.
And what does it mean to you when activists, George, from the United States, actually grassroots activists, governors, senators, mayors, nonprofits from all over, come as a kind of separate delegation from the Trump delegation? We have 15 seconds.
I think it's important because we don't stand alone in this fight, you know. Even though we face the impacts of climate change back home, we know that we're in this fight with others around the world, and that's very important, you know.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And, of course, we're going to continue to discuss this. Tetet Laurent, Iban International, George Nathewa from Fiji is a 350.org Pacific climate warrior. When we come back, a group of U.S. lawmakers are here in Bonn staging an anti-Trump revolt by declaring we are still in. That's in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. We'll speak with Senators Markey of Massachusetts and Schatz of Hawaii. Stay with us.
Solve it, get involved and do it now, now, now. We need to build a better future, and we need to start.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany. I'm Amy Goodman. Despite President Trump's vows to pull the United States out of the landmark 2015 Paris Accord, there are a number of U.S. senators, mayors, governors who are staging an anti-Trump revolt here in Bonn. This is Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse speaking in Bonn on Saturday.
The primary point that I want to make is that the Trump administration is not only isolated in the world community on this issue, but also isolated within America on this issue. Congress has many strong voices who oppose the Trump administration. Governors, mayors, American corporations, our NGO community are all continuing ahead.
That's White House, not to be confused, though, with the White House. That's the Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. The lawmakers are part of a coalition of cities, universities, faith groups and companies who are in Bonn, Germany, to reject Trump's vow to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Accord and instead proclaim we are still in. Well, on Saturday, Democracy Now! Asked a number of these senators and mayors what they mean when they say we're still in. Among them, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey. I began by asking him why he's here at the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany.
We're here to tell the world that Donald Trump does not represent the majority view in our country, that overwhelmingly people do believe that the planet is dangerously warming and that human activity is causing it and that we have to do something about it. So we just want them to know that inside our country, mayors, governors, private sector companies and individuals are continuing to move forward to meet the goal that was committed by the United States to the world.
But what does that mean? I mean, if President Trump says he's pulling the U.S. out, what does it mean to say you're pushing to meet the goals?
There are existing federal laws on the books that we will not allow him to repeal. There are existing state
laws. Like
the fuel economy standards that that push our country towards over 50 miles per gallon by the year 2025. We are going to fight to make sure that stays on the books. The state laws for renewable electricity to be deployed in state after state, those laws are not going to be repealed. The appliance efficiency standard that ensure that the toasters, the stoves, the light bulbs are made ever more efficient, we're going to fight for that as well. So ultimately, it's the amount of pollution that goes up into the sky, and that comes from appliances. It comes from buildings. It comes from vehicles that are driven. And we are just here to tell them that we are going to make it very difficult for the president to roll back any of those standards. And at the state level and the city level, it's going to continue to move forward very aggressively, along with hundreds of companies in our country who are committed to raising their goals.
So there's the We're Still In coalition that you're a part of. You're still in the climate accord. But then there's also the Trump administration. They actually are making the trip over here, some of them, to hold a news conference pushing nuclear and coal and gas. Your thoughts on this?
The Trump administration is looking at the world in a rearview mirror, but going forward, when there are auctions in country after country. For example, Mexico had an auction for solar power that came in at 3 cents a kilowatt hour. That's below the cost of natural gas. It's below the cost of coal. So this is a revolution that they can't stop. The economics of the renewable revolution are now out of the control of governments. They are now out in the economic marketplace. And we're here to tell them that we understand that, that the economics of renewables, of all electric vehicles, are all moving inexorably towards the day when his attempt to protect the fossil fuel economy is just not going to be successful.
What's going to happen with President Trump's nomination for his environmental policy advisor, Kathleen Hartnett White, who said carbon dioxide is harmless, actually a plant nutrient, and she described wind and solar power as unreliable and parasitic. She says climate change is a dogma that has little to do with science. And in a blog, she said coal dissolved the economic justification for slavery.
I sit on the committee that had the hearing with her testifying last week. She and her nomination are an embarrassment to our country. She does not believe in science. She does not believe in the harm that CO2 does. She is somebody that is only reflecting the views of corporate America, the fossil fuel industry. So the Democrats are going to fight her as hard as anyone has ever been fought in our committee and on the floor of the United States Senate. We are going to make sure that every Republican understands that it will be one of the most embarrassing moments of their lives if they vote to confirm her to a position of high responsibility over the environment in our country.
Do you have any Republican allies on the committee?
I think that there is perhaps here a bridge too far, that it might just be something that is so egregious, so bad, that Republicans of conscience, who we know really do want to protect the environment, will have to stand up and say no. And we think that we have an excellent chance to defeat her and to defeat Michael Dorson, who has been put in charge of toxics as well. I don't think Republicans want to vote on either one of them.
Explain who Dorson is and what he represents.
Michael Dorson is someone who worked for the chemical industry, who has now been nominated to take over regulation of toxic chemicals in our country. There's one chemical, for example, 1,4-dioxane, that scientists at the EPA have come to a conclusion as to what is acceptable exposure for human beings without, in fact, contracting cancer. He believes that human beings can be exposed to 1,000 times that level of 1,4-dioxane. We think that's an embarrassing vote for the Republicans out on the Senate floor as well, and we're going to make sure that everyone understands how bad not only he is, but his other environmental nominees.
You know, President Trump says he's going to relax the car emission standards.
Yes.
And I want to ask overall, it is a repeated mantra in the U.S. media that Trump hasn't been able to pass any meaningful legislation.
Yes.
But that obscures the fact that the EPA head, Scott Pruitt, is pushing fast and furious, repealing one rule regulation after another around the environment. Perhaps, as Bill McKibben said on Democracy Now yesterday, the environment is the place that President Trump is making the most progress or regressing us the most.
Well, on fuel economy standards, California and all of the other states that are part of the California waiver, they're going to have a say on that. And I don't think any of those states intend on relenting. So there's going to be a prolonged, bitter battle in the courts before the Trump administration can be successful on fuel economy standards. And at the end of the day, they're going to lose.
And what about the fact that the EPA is moving to repeal so many environmental standards and succeeding?
Without question, the Trump administration is trying to turn the EPA into every polluter's ally. But at the end of the day, they cannot repeal the Clean Air Act. They cannot repeal the Clean Water Act. They cannot repeal law after law. They can try to move the regulations in their discretion to a more conservative perspective, but that will be temporary. When the Democrats return or some normal Republican administration returns, then I think that the underlying statutes will still be on the books, because we don't intend on allowing Trump to repeal one single law, even if he can change or interpret the regulations under the existing laws for a 2 or 3 year period, knowing as well that the NRDC, the Sierra Club, and other public interest groups and the attorneys general of the United States are going to sue Trump on any regulation that Scott Pruitt tries to change. It will be years before he's successful on any significant regulation.
Senator Markey, we just returned from Puerto Rico. And as we're flying here to Bonn, San Juan, which was the most electrified area, still the majority of people not getting electricity, actually lost their electricity. Can you talk about what will happen with Puerto Rico? The people of Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens.
Puerto Rico is an ongoing tragedy. It unfortunately is something that has had the Trump administration think of them as second-class citizens and not giving them the commitment which they need. The mayor of San Juan, Mayor Cruz, she speaks for me and I think the majority of the American people, that they are not ingrates. They're American citizens. They are people who are entitled to all of the full protections and benefits of our country. In Congress, before the end of this year, we're going to have a mighty battle over this, over what is happening with the American response, the American government's response down there. And we have to make sure that there's full funding that goes to Puerto Rico in the same way that it would go to Louisiana or Texas or Florida if they had a catastrophe. And we're going to make sure we have that battle.
FEMA has just said that they will move out thousands of Puerto Ricans to the mainland. We were just speaking with a Puerto Rican activist who is here, deeply concerned about the answer being not solving the issue of Puerto Rico and all that has to happen right now that also goes to its debt and what's going to happen there, but just moving Puerto Ricans out.
Yeah. There are estimates that upwards of 500,000 Puerto Ricans could just leave permanently that island and not go back again. That's just wrong. These people should be given an option that they know that the American government is coming in to help them in a very brief period of time to rebuild their homes, to rebuild their towns. Otherwise, they're almost economic refugees being forced to flee to Florida or Massachusetts or New York or New Jersey or Illinois, which is where they're heading. That's wrong. We should actually commit the resources that give them hope for a future in their own hometown so that they don't actually have to think about leaving.
Will you be investigating Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary? Whitefish Energy gets this $300 million contract. Whitefish, of course, named for his hometown and how it's possible that when Hurricane Maria hit, there were two people who Whitefish had two people and they got a $300 million contract. Now the governor says they're going to cancel it. Not clear what's going to happen with it.
Yeah, that contract is absolutely something that should raise the eyebrows of every member of the Senate so that they hit it, so that they hit the ceiling. That's how bad that deal is. A company that has no experience, very few employees, is given the job of maybe the major reconstruction of an electric grid system in the history of our country. It's so wrong from step one that it's not even really debatable, but yet in this Trump administration, it is. And so we need to make sure that we use that as an example that illuminates the soul of the Trump administration when it comes to how the people of Puerto Rico are treated.
What is your view on nuclear power? It seems that a number even of progressives are starting to say, well, it's better than coal, it's better than gas. But so many people have fought nuclear power in this country for so many years.
The economics of nuclear power are absolutely abysmal. Westinghouse went bankrupt trying to build nuclear power for the people of Georgia and South Carolina. And that's been what has happened over the last 30 years. It never did come back from Three Mile Island or Chernobyl or any of the other questions that have been raised over the years. It's just almost impossible for them now to to receive private sector funding. That's why we have the Price-Anderson Act that has the American people covering a major meltdown to the tune of $20 billion or more if something goes wrong. You don't need that with renewables. You don't need that with natural gas. And I think ultimately utility executives are rational, and they're going to move towards the kinds of electrical generating technologies that are drawing the bulk, overwhelming bulk, of a private sector investment.
Perhaps the greatest threat to the environment is nuclear war. President Trump has certainly upped the ante when it comes to North Korea, saying he's going to unleash fire and fury on a population of 25 million. Your thoughts as he comes back from Asia now?
On Tuesday night, we're going to have a hearing in the Foreign Relations Committee. I asked Senator Bob Corker, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, to have a hearing on the use of nuclear weapons by the United States first in a conflict with the North Koreans or any other country. It's time for us to have this debate across our country. Should the United States be the country that initiates a nuclear war, even if we have not been attacked by nuclear weapons? We need a national referendum on this issue. Donald Trump, no single human being should have the power to use nuclear weapons when they have not been used by an opponent, an adversary of our country.
Do you feel we're closer to nuclear war now?
I think it's very possible on the Korean Peninsula that we could slip into a situation where conventional war escalates so quickly that nuclear weapons becomes contemplatable on both sides. And I'm also concerned that there may be a plan by the U.S. government to use small nuclear bombs, baby nuclear bombs, to go in and surgically try to attack the nuclear weapons systems inside of North Korea. The problem with that is that even the Pentagon has concluded that there's no guarantee that we would have knocked out all of the nuclear weapons capacity of North Korea, which could still leave them with the capacity to launch against South Korea, where we have 200,000 Americans, including 30,000 military personnel, or towards Japan, or towards Guam. It would be catastrophic.
And let me ask you a quick question about Roy Moore. Your thoughts on the Alabama Republican candidate for the Senate seat. Three women at this point have accused him of sexually abusing them, one when she was 14 years old.
It's obvious that he should pull out of the race to become the new senator from the state of Alabama. But it's clear that the old saying, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue, applies to Roy Moore. He's always said the right thing, but now he has a chance to do the right thing. But it's not clear that he's going to.
And lastly, this all happens in an era of Trump, when already more than a dozen women have accused him of sexual abuse. He said he would sue them after the election. The election came and went. He's not sued any of them. Already one has sued him for libel for calling her a liar.
I think that from Harvey Weinstein to Roy Moore to all the other revelations, it's pretty clear that we have kind of crossed over into a new era, which is a great new era, which is that women are speaking up. They're trying to make our country become more accountable for what has been a culture which has existed for far too long.
That was Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. Well, on Saturday, we also got a chance to speak with Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. I began by asking him why he's here in Bonn, Germany.
Well, we want to send the unequivocal message that although the president has taken the wrong position with regard to climate generally and specifically with regard to staying in the Paris Climate Accords, that the United States is still in. The framework that allows us to make progress on clean energy is a couple of things. First, it's the investment tax credit and the production tax credit, which is federal law. Second, it's the Clean Air Act, which is federal law. He is not a monarch. He cannot repeal that law. He doesn't have 60 votes. He doesn't even have 50 votes. And so people don't necessarily understand that although the president is making unhelpful statements, he is not in charge of clean energy policy. We are making progress at the state level, at the city level, and through the private sector. So the clean energy revolution will continue regardless of what he and Scott Pruitt want.
Tell us how climate change affects Hawaii.
Hawaii feels so passionately about climate. You know, our oceans are warming. As a result, we have more ocean acidification and coral bleaching. You can actually see it. There was a summer during which the whole south shore of Oahu, you could see the bleached coral almost across all of the surfing spots. And so it's gone from an issue that only environmentalists cared about to an issue that almost everybody in the state of Hawaii cares about, because it's really affecting our quality of life. And so as a result, we're taking action. We have the first clean energy statute that requires 100% of all of our energy to be produced from clean, renewable resources by the year 2045. We started with, similar to the COP21, with voluntary targets. And not ambitious enough targets, similar to what the UN has done. But we ratcheted up our ambition over a period of time. Then we made it mandatory. Then we exceeded those targets. Now we've almost quadrupled clean energy production in the state of Hawaii. And last year, we finally signed a law to say 100% clean energy.
You've been senator for 5 years. The last year, President Trump was elected. How has this country changed? How has it affected Hawaii this past year?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, President Trump, in a lot of ways, not just on policy, but in terms of style, is everything that Hawaii is not. We believe that our diversity is a strength and not a weakness. We believe in each other. We want to protect each other. And so he really is offending the sensibilities of so many people across the state of Hawaii. And in a lot of ways, you know, we took pride in President Obama's even-keeled behavior, this idea that you can disagree without being disagreeable. And President Trump is everything that we are taught not to be growing up in Hawaii.
Finally, what's your message for an island president? In fact, President Trump is from New York City. Manhattan is an island, and New York has a huge coastline. Both identifying with that from Hawaii to New York, and then the Pacific Islands. Leader is the president of the COP, and of course, the Pacific Islands are suffering immensely from human-induced climate change.
Islands are going to suffer from climate change in very, very difficult ways. And it's not just Pacific Islands, it's not just Puerto Rico, but you're right, it's coastal areas up and down the east coast of the United States of America. Boston is really vulnerable. New York City is very vulnerable. I know the state of Maine is contending with tremendous challenges as lobster migrates north. You know, nobody can escape climate change, and it's no longer just something that environmentalists care about. This is a quality of life issue. This is an economic issue. It's a moral issue. It's a fiscal issue, and we've got to solve it together.
How do you identify with Puerto Rico?
Well, we're, you know, I think the challenging thing with the Puerto Rico situation is that I don't feel they're getting the respect that they would get if they were closer to the United States, and we have to make sure that we help them to recover. And I thought they should have mobilized the United States military instantly, as they would have if this had happened in an American state as opposed to a territory.
Do you think it's racism?
I don't want to characterize it. I just think they made the wrong decision.
And my last question doesn't relate to climate change, but to immigration, though there are many climate refugees. And that question is about Jeff Sessions speaking on a right-wing radio talk show about the judge, the federal judge in Hawaii, who stopped the Muslim ban. And he said, that's Jeff Sessions, he said, how is it possible that a man on an island in the Pacific can stop the president of the United States? Senator Schatz, what's your response?
That island in the Pacific is Oahu. It's where I live. It's the capital of the 50th state, the state of Hawaii. And I would just add that Jeff Sessions voted for that judge.
That's Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. Later this week, we'll bring you a special report on the resistance to the largest open-pit coal mine in Europe. That open-pit coal mine is just miles down the road from the UN climate summit. We went there on Sunday and visited the Treesit Hundreds of people have been involved with this protest for years. Thousands came out last weekend. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid six-month internships. Go to democracynow.org for information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felch, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Nicole Salazar, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, broadcasting all week from Bonn, Germany.